it's another of our podcast specials. This time, the culinary delights of Israel's Galilee. From the latest on Caribbean cruises to kosher safaris, pilgrimages to Jewish Eastern Europe and award-winning wines and international cuisine in sun-drenched Tel Aviv. Sit back and enjoy the trip with the travel edition of the Jerusalem Post podcast. And a very warm welcome indeed. I'm David Harris. My colleague Mark Gordon sadly isn't with us this time. He's off travelling somewhere in the Middle East for an upcoming podcast. More details on that to follow. However, before Mark went away, he and I headed to northern Israel, to what's known as the Lower Galilee, for a special culinary tour. We did it in the company of Paul Nirons, who's the founder of Galil Eat. We'll hear a lot more about that organisation later in the podcast, but for now we'll just say that Galil Eat organises cooking workshops, home hospitality, meals in local Galilean villages, cross-cultural immersion, full-day culinary tours, and much more. We decided with Paul ahead of time that we would visit three of his hosts, one Druze, one Muslim, and first a Christian. Rudaina lives in Dir Hanna, which is a mixed Muslim and Christian town. She welcomed us with open arms and a couple of aprons. Here's what happened.
I've been working with Paul for 5 years, and all who come are satisfied. I love preparing all sorts of food. I learned from my mom, a great cook. I make majadara, okra, stuffed vine leaves, pumpkin, kafta and tahini, everything. Today we're making malatit cookies.
Mark is currently mixing water and sugar. There's a cup and a half of sugar and a fair bit of water. There's a couple of cups of water. While he's doing that, Paul, how did you get into cooking in the first place?
My father was a chef. We had a family restaurant in Melbourne. And when I made Aliyah in 1984, I worked in agriculture for a while, but it wasn't really what I wanted to do. And so I studied cooking, and then I worked my way up. I was a chef in a vegetarian restaurant. I worked in a hotel. I call myself a chef. I'm not actually convinced. Well, I was a chef in a restaurant, so therefore I am a chef, but I'm certainly not a great chef. But anyway, I gave the profession up because it was too important to be with my family. I had four young children. I wanted to stay with my, see my kids and not work shift work and everything like that. So that's my cooking background. But certainly I have a pretty vast cooking and food background. And I'm very inquisitive and I love travelling. So that's my background, and then I got this idea from something that I did in Umbria. And I transposed Umbrian cooking in Umbria to Galilean cooking in the Galilee, and it's great. It's fantastic.
I've got hands like a mummy at the moment. They're just covered in dough because I've done everything with my hands, so I'm off to wash them.
Rodena has just added 1.5 cups of sesame seeds. Toasted sesame seeds, and the sesame seeds themselves are actually grown in the valley beneath us. It's one of the few places in Israel where sesame is grown. And now she's about to add katzach, nigella in English.
Oh, I love it. That is my favourite thing that I've discovered since living in Israel. Now, there are some people who call it black sesame. Is that accurate?
Totally inaccurate. Black sesame or black cumin sometimes, it's neither. It's not a member of either family. But because it's a small seed that sort of resembles it and it's got a very earthy flavour, then that's how it got its name, but it's definitely a misnomer. It's called nigella in English, and it's a totally different product.
So we're putting in just two tablespoons, and in a minute I can see that there is anise.
Yes,
aniseed.
Aniseed.
Mark is learning to count.
Three. I think we're getting a fourth heaped tablespoon of anise. Tahun.
Ground.
I've stolen the microphone off David and Mark because they've both got their hands full making dough and now they're making cookies. I think for them this is something fascinating. They're actually using a net, I guess you'd call it, and Rodena is showing them how to do it. David is placing the dough on the rack. And then he's rolling it with his fingers to make a very nicely shaped little cookie, which is going to go in the oven. How about that? What do you think about that?
Hers look absolutely amazing. Mine looks like I don't know if I'm allowed to say this. It looks like an elongated white poo.
Okay, it looks like it's going to end up on the bottom of the cutting room floor. Okay, I'm going to move it over to Mark and see what Mark has to say.
I wish I could elongate mine. I'm not getting the pattern here. I think I'm being very gentle. Mine looks like a dead snail.
Yeah, it does, actually. What you guys are not doing, you're not putting in the little slit that's in the middle. And that's pretty good. Mark, that's very good. You got the hang of it.
I've done one. I think I'll sit down now.
No. You don't get off that easily.
So we've cleaned our hands. We're slowly taking off our aprons. And a gorgeous meal has appeared on the table. Paul, what have we got in front of us?
We have Galilean majadara, which is lentils with bulgur wheat and burnt onions. And I'm actually quite serious that the onions have to be really carbonized and not caramelized. And then we have okra cooked up in a fresh tomato sauce with lots and lots and lots of garlic. And then we just have a Galilean vegetable salad. But what's great about it is that the vegetables are from the fields behind Rodena's house. And they're not bought from the supermarket or even from the local fruiterer. So they're great. And there's also homemade goat's yogurt that is eaten traditionally with the majadara. And homemade pickles I see Rodena has brought out. She always brings out too much food. That's why I look the way I look. So homemade pickled cucumbers and homemade pickled olives.
Batavon.
Well, that was a feast for king and queen, and this is only the first course. Rodena, you are a wonderful cook. The food is amazing. We've got a bag full of phenomenal aniseed-based cookies to take with us. Thank you so much.
Thank you. You're welcome.
Well, now we've climbed up and up and up and up and up. Unfortunately, your guests, your listeners can't see it, but we're now on top of a beautiful mountain in the village of Mrar, which is in quite close to the Sea of Galilee. And we're about to enter into Penina's home. Penina is an Orthodox Druze woman, and we're going to do a little bit of cooking there and hear her story. And we're going to have a lot of fun because we always have fun.
In a word, what is Druze? I realise that's there's going to be a long answer, but I imagine most people listening to this don't know.
The Druze are obviously Arabs. In other words, Arabic is their mother tongue. They live in the Levant, from Haifa northwards, all through what is the traditional Galilee region, both Lebanon and Syria. They broke off from Islam 1,000 years ago, but they're not Islamic. They're a separate religion, monotheistic religion, and their principle, one of the things that they're most famous for is their belief in reincarnation. It's a very, very strong tenet in what they believe, but they're just another Semitic monotheistic religion that are just small and very nice people.
Let's say hello to Penina.
Nina?
Hi. Shalom.
So David and Mark.
Hi.
Naimod. Pleased to meet you.
So we've come to Penina's in
Mrar. And it's a gur in the back of the throat. We don't have in Hebrew, forget English. And so it's spelt in a number of different ways because there's a letter there that we don't have in Hebrew or English. Same with Gaza, sometimes Azza.
So what's the plan here?
Okay, well, because we haven't eaten yet today, we're about to make some zalabia. Zalabia is, I guess, a fried bread, you'd call it. If we have any Yemenite listeners, the Yemenite Jews also make zalabia, which is similar but not the same. Now, I don't know why they make zalabia and why in the village of Mrar and nowhere else in the Galilee do they make zalabia. Go figure.
I think there's an Indian food called jalabi as well. I'm not sure if it's related.
I think it's a sweet Indian. I think
this is a savoury bread.
Yeah, it's very savoury. You'll see, it's got all the usual. It's got all the usual suspects in terms of sesame and aniseed and a bit of cardamom and all the good stuff. Mm. And we're going to make that. And again, like all my hosts, Panina's probably made too much because she thinks that we're starving, even though she knows that I don't look like I am.
We've got those gaunt, starving faces about us.
Yeah, gaunt. Yeah, that's the worst ever been described about me. But anyway, so that's what we're doing here. But we also will hear a little bit about Panina, and either we'll translate because, again, we are in her home in the beautiful village, and so we do want to hear a little bit about who she is.
It is one thing about the places you've brought us so far. We've been in two houses, and the views are just otherworldly, just panoramic views of the mountains around the Galilee. It's beautiful.
I'm going to sound like a bit of a chauvinist here, and I can't help it. I'm never politically correct. But I feel sorry for you people living in the periphery. Us people living in the center, and for me, the Galilee is the center. When you have views like this, and people and neighbors like I have who work with me, I feel like I'm in the center. And that you people living, you know, in the plains, it's sort of in my periphery. I know that's not a very nice thing to say, but that's the way it goes.
No, we've sacrificed this view for phone reception and flat roads, and I'm not sure which one I'd rather have.
Yeah, flat roads, a bit of a drive up here.
Brochim abaim labayit sheli.
This is Panina. She's a 61-year-old Druze woman. She's got three kids. Her oldest is 38. Her son is 33. She has a 28-year-old daughter who's a speech therapist, but she's also studying now computer science. I'm widowed. My husband passed away at a very young age from a heart attack. And widows within the Druze religion can remarry, but the custom is that they don't remarry because the custom dictates that if a Druze widow remarries, she loses everything, and everything includes the house and the children that remain the property of the deceased husband's family. And of course, no widow is going to do that. And so that is the custom within the Druze, so Panina never remarried. The Druze are a minority. In Israel, there's about 130,000. There's a small minority in Jordan. There's a larger group of about 140,000 in Lebanon, but the majority of Druze are in southern Syria. We're monotheistic. There are Druze all over the world, and we are monotheistic. And we believe in reincarnation. Because of our belief in reincarnation, it is forbidden for us to marry outside of the faith. So there's no religious coercion with the Druze. That's to say that you can be either a religious Druze or a non-religious Druze, and both are perfectly acceptable. And even within one house, sometimes there are a parent or someone who is religious and someone who isn't religious, and that's absolutely acceptable. It's your own choice. If you are a religious Druze, there's a certain dress code. It's forbidden to smoke or to drink alcohol. You are expected to go to the prayers on Thursday evenings. The Druze belief in reincarnation states that the moment you pass away, you are reborn, your soul is reborn in a new Druze baby. Both parents must be Druze, a new Druze baby anywhere in the Druze world. And because you are reborn, essentially the body has no value. So once the person has passed away, is buried, it is forbidden for the Druze to go and visit the grave because all that's there is a bunch of bones, whereas the soul is in a better place, in a young baby somewhere else. We're commanded, but it's not just a matter of commanded. We want to have people in our homes, and it's something that's very important to us. And Panina made the comment, and I certainly agree with her, that I have a number of Druze hosts. You always feel that you're at home, that you're welcome, that you're wanted here, because the Druze are just open and they want people to be with them. It's very much a part of, I wouldn't say religion, but I would certainly say custom. Now we're going to make zelabia, and David, in fact, is the one that's going to make the little dough balls to start off with. So what you have to do is oil your hands. It's olive oil, so your hands are going to be very soft tonight. And then it's a very, very, very soft, pliable dough. You make balls about the size of a tennis ball. Yeah, about that size. That's made already.
Yeah, I just picked up one that was ready done.
Take the rest of the dough and make it. You've probably got enough there for two or maybe three balls.
So when we were making the last thing, I had to start from scratch and flour. and you've essentially got dough, two of which are already made into the right size balls. So they clearly know about your culinary skills, and you basically have to spit a bit of dough into two.
I wanted just the feeling of the olive oil on my hands. And
try making it more of it like trying.
He's criticizing me already. I've only just started.
I'm giving constructive help.
Go for it.
Try pulling it so it's smoother. It doesn't have to be very, very smooth because we're going to flatten it out.
Panina's obviously seen enough. She's gone to answer her phone rather than watch you slaughter that dough that she's slaved hard to make.
One of the reasons why we didn't get you to do it is because the dough is a yeast dough and it's a very, very, very yeasty. You can actually smell the yeast.
Oh, yeah, that smells like bread.
Okay, so I've now got on my hands olive oil and the dough. I've got no idea what's in the dough. I mean, I heard a few words earlier, but let me try to guess just from smelling my hands what's on here. Yeast.
The man's a genius.
And steering wheel.
It's really, really hard to say what's in here. It's a mix of herbs.
It's actually ketach, which is, again, the ubiquitous nigella seeds that we had in the cookies.
Do we say nigella or nigella?
You say either, I say either. I'm not quite sure what the
right
pronunciation
is. Is it because there's a famous English chef called Nigella Lawson, so the automatic response is to say nigella?
Yeah, could be, but I think these seeds came before Nigella.
Yeah, and she's named after her father called Nigel. That's why she's Nigella.
I didn't know that. Yeah. Okay. There's also, again, whole sesame seeds. You can see here. There's also...
flour, olive oil.
Yeah, flour, olive oil. There's also a little bit of cardamom in this.
Is there something green in here as well?
Oh, yeah, za'atar. Hyssop.
We've moved over to the kitchen, to the hob, the stovetop, where there's lots of hot oil. I'm standing furthest back with the longest microphone.
So what you're going to do now is your hands are still oily. You're going to take one of these balls and flatten it out with your hands, with your oily hands. Flatten it even more. It's a very, very pliable dough. Use your fingers, in fact, to thinner than that. Yep, you're doing it fantastic.
Turn it over?
No, you don't turn it over, but spread it out even thinner. Thinner, thinner, thinner.
It's thinner.
No, it's not thin enough. Okay, that's a little bit thinner.
How's my shape?
Your shape is perfect. Okay, now take your index finger, make holes exactly in the dough. Make about 5 or 6 or 7 holes. Perfect.
So we've got this sort of bready looking dough. It's around about, 4 inches by 5 inches, something like that.
One of the ingredients, that I didn't tell you that was in it, which is almost the most important ingredient, is turmeric, of course. It's bright yellow, the dough, because it's got turmeric. You need to spread it out a little bit thinner and make more holes.
Kind of like a British crumpet with the holes.
The difference between this and a crumpet, a British crumpet, is that the holes are only on the top. We're putting holes all the way through.
I always had a different understanding of the word crumpet, but maybe... maybe I misunderstand.
For British people, that's from the Carry On films.
Yes, that is true. Now pick it up and very gently place it in the hot oil.
Paul is now frying the microphone.
So how long does it need to cook for?
You'll see, not very long. By the time you've got the next one ready, we'll turn it and take it out.
Are there many Druze people called Panina?
I think I got a beautiful name, but 62 years ago, no Druze man gave his daughter the name Panina. And when I was going through the village and people would ask me when I was a child, what's his name, Panina? It's a Jewish name. And Panina never gave it much thought until she was about 15 or 16 years old. And so I started work in a factory, and I showed the work manager my ID card, and it said Panina, and he looked at Panina and said, "What, a Druze woman, Panina? That can't be." And so that day I decided I was going to go home and ask my father. And so my father asked around at the dinner table, how was your first day in the factory? Did you get the job? How was it? And Panina says, "No, even before that, I want to ask you, how did I get my name Panina?"
he had a furtive glance to Penina's mother. He started laughing. He says, all right, I'll tell you how you got the name Penina. My father, may rest in peace, was one of the very first Druze to actually go into the army. And her mother was pregnant with their first child. Penina's father was in the army. And, of course, there were lots of Jewish girls there who also had been conscripted to the army. And he made a promise. He had a friend whose name was Penina, and he made a promise that if firstborn was a girl, he would give them the Jewish name Penina, after a friend in the army. But mum, she goes, no, there's a different story to this. Penina's mother was pregnant, was quite a long way down the road, so to speak. And so there were no baby clothing shops in this small village in those days. And so they went to Tiberias, where there were some clothing shops. Of course, they didn't know whether to buy blue or pink. And so they went into the clothing shop. The saleswoman in the shop looked at Penina's mother, who was 9 months pregnant, and said, I think you're going to have a daughter. And so Penina's father, who actually wanted a daughter, promised if it was a daughter, he would name the new baby after the saleswoman in the shop, and the name of the saleswoman in the shop, of course, was Penina. Penina's brother was always a bit of a joker, and he basically came out and said, maybe the saleswoman in the shop in Tiberias is actually Dad's girlfriend from the army, and that's why Dad went to that shop, knowing all the time. Of course, we'll never know. The most important thing is I got a beautiful name, and that's what's most important to me. And it's a very special name, and I will say for a very special woman.
So, having got my hands all oily, I've had the pleasure of cleaning them, and now I'm about to try a piece of, what's it called again?
Zalabia.
Try this amazing looking zalabia. Imagine if you're at a fairground and you see, I guess, almost like a flat donut with lots of holes in, but with the greens and the golds of the various herbs. So I'm going to try that. I'm going to try it on its own first. That is really divine, and I'm not just saying it because I'm holding a microphone. Always bothers me when you watch chefs on TV. It doesn't matter what they're trying. It's always perfect. Now I'm going to dip it in some labneh, which is a sour, usually goat's or sheep's cheese, with some za'atar. And next to it, I've also got a lettuce, onion, and tomato salad, which is heavily garliced. And that is absolutely outstanding.
So we've finished our second wonderful cooking experience, a meal of the day. We're gonna leave now. Penina, thank you so much for hosting us. It's been a real pleasure to be here and to learn another cooking skill and to see more of the Galilee.
Thank you so much.
Thanks a lot. Goodbye.
Galilee Fact File. The Galilee region of Israel has a diverse population numbering just over 1.5 million people. We visited Mechar, a mixed town of 23,000 people, which is 70% Druze, Dir Hanna, a district of 10,000 inhabitants, 80% Muslim and 20% Christian, and Kalkab Abu Lahija, an all-Muslim village of 3,500 residents. Muslim, Christian and Druze cooking are similar and can loosely be defined as Galilean peasant cooking. The Bedouin diet is slightly different, reflecting their nomadic roots. Cinnamon is used extensively in the Galilean kitchen, and the local diet is heavily influenced by the seasons and what is available locally. Galilee started 9 years ago and works with 8 host families from Daliat al-Karmel through to Majd al-Shams. Our host, Paul Nirons, can be contacted by calling Israel 972-55-881-0727 or emailing paul at galilite.com. The website is galilite.com and the Facebook Galilite Israel and with the Instagram Galilite.
So having gone down a couple of blind alleys and taken our time to get here, where are we now and what are we doing?
We're in the village of Kawkab Abu al-Hijja, although it's usually known as Kawkab, here in the Galilee. It's a mostly Muslim village. In fact, we're about to go in to see my Muslim host, Sada. And that's where we are. And like all my hosts, I love her like I love all my hosts.
Are we going to be cooking again?
You guys are going to be rolling some vine leaves.
My name is Sada Ali, and I work at a community college in Sakhnin. I've been working there for over 10 years. I do what I do with Paul because I really like cooking, you know, and I do it occasionally. It's not like an everyday thing, you know. I enjoy hosting people. I enjoy meeting people. And I think it's a way to connect people together and get people closer to each other. And I kind of find that out true whenever we start hosting people in my home. I believe that people will come in a different idea and they would leave in a totally different idea, which is usually more positive than negative. So I kind of find that appealing.
One thing we found while we've worked our way is there is a sense of identity of being part of the Galilee. Do you feel that the Galilee is a very welcoming place, a very special part of this country?
I do. I feel this is the most welcoming place in Israel, actually, the Galilee area. Because, you see, Jewish and Arabs, they live very close to each other. And they neighbor, and they work together, and they're always together, you know what I'm saying?
What do you like to cook? Do you have a favorite meal, a favorite dish?
I have many favorite dishes. I like to cook the food that I grew up eating. It's an authentic food that my mom used to grow up in our backyard and front yard. I lived in a house where my mom and dad owned 3 acres of land. So we basically grew everything. We grew up in the field, you know, picking tomatoes from the yard, potatoes, pepper, greens, all of it. So we grew up eating the authentic food that I really like, and that's what I host mostly my guests.
It's definitely been a feature while we've been up here that each of our hosts has brought in an element of food that they've grown themselves. And I think that really has enhanced what we've eaten so far. David and I live down in the center of Israel. Nobody has land there. No one grows their own food. We all go to the supermarket. And I think it's really nice to actually have something that is grown on your land that you've put the effort into to put on the table.
Yeah, we don't have land anymore. That was growing up, you know. You're talking about the quality? Yeah. Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, I can tell you, for example, when my mom used to grow the potatoes, tomatoes, beans, pepper, parsley, you know, whatever else we grew up, we had never used chemicals, never.
Yeah.
So it was all organic, and it has that heavenly taste that you don't really find nowadays in the market.
Everything is sort of chemically grown and to make it bigger, to grow quicker.
I mean, the tomato had even a different color. You know, the tomato was like purple red, you know, and smaller, but yet it has that taste. I mean, I can still remember that taste. I mean, you can buy tomatoes now so big, but yet it's like water, tastes basically nothing, because, you know, they added so much chemicals and stuff. And so
my growing up experience with cucumbers in England, they're like this long.
Yeah,
which no one listening can see, but they're probably a foot long, at least, and
exactly.
Just watery.
Yeah, like right now, you can find cucumbers all season. Growing up, cucumbers was in the summer. That's it. No more cucumbers. In the winter, you can't find them because they're seasonal.
Change of subject slightly. Can you describe life in Kawkab? I'll be honest, it's not a place I'd heard of before we were brought here today.
I did not grow up here. I grew up in Sakhnin.
Okay.
It's a town close by. That's where I work. Kawkab is a beautiful, unique little village, honestly. It's very, very unique. The way I see it, it's nice inside out. You know, the people here are very, very intelligent. They're so much into studying and going to schools, and the competition is so high when it comes to schools and all. I'm talking about academic schools. And people are working, they're busy, you know, doing their own things, and they make like their best to keep the little village clean and organized and nice. And so I like the village a lot. It's only 3,000 people here, 3,500 probably.
Am I right in thinking there's sort of an arty theme to the village? In coming here, I read there's like a park with an art feature here.
Yes, true.
Which is spread through the village.
Yes. People are into art, into, like I said, studying, into making better, you know, for themselves and for others even. People try to make a good relation with the neighbors and with each other also. You know, you don't find problems here, like when elections and stuff. You know, whoever wins, you know, we shake his hand.
What are you going to show us in your kitchen?
Today, I'm going to show you all how to roll grape leaves, which is something, like I said, I grew up with. We used to pick the leaves from the garden, you know, and roll them fresh and tasty and organic and stuff. We're going to have some tabbouleh, which is also a traditional salad that I grew up with. Yeah, that's what we're having today.
So, Sada, explain to Mark how you roll vine leaves.
To roll the vine leaves, we have to have the shiny side down and the unshiny side up. Because I tell you why. Once we put the rice like this and we roll the leaves, look at that. We have a beautiful shiny leaf.
It looks very delicate. I'm not the most delicate person. So
see that? We just put a little bit here. And we roll like 1, 2, 3, and 4. And we roll it like a little cigarette.
They're much thinner than the ones that I've seen before. When you get them in a can. I know this is being handmade, but in a can they tend to be thicker.
Rice expands, you know. That's what you need.
Is this uncooked rice?
Yes, it's raw. The rice is raw.
It's easiest if you have the pointed part of the leaf away from you. And so the flatter bottom of the leaf towards you, and that way you'll know how to put the row of rice and where to roll it. And so we're going to. It's a pity that people can't see this because this could be quite amusing.
You can see that so far my technique has been to do one badly and then get out of it so I can watch. But I'm going to have to put the microphone down and have another try.
Just use that's way too much. Again, just a little bit because rice does expands. Okay. Now roll it 1 and 2. There you go. You're doing good. 3. Okay. And roll it tight. Tight. That's not tight. But that's okay.
It's my first one. They'll improve, hopefully.
A friend of mine have a field that they grew these for selling, you know, for business. And I go pick them. My hand. They're not high. That's a good thing. They're not very high. They grew these so they can sell it. So they grow it very, very low.
We're recording this about a month ahead of Eid al-Adha, which is the next Muslim festival. What type of food do you cook for the various Muslim festivals, whether it's Eid al-Fitr, Eid al-Adha, whether it's during Ramadan, the evening meals? What type of dishes do you serve?
Okay, for Ramadan, I cook like a different meal every night. And I always have soup, always. Soup and salad, we always have to have. And then all kind of stuff I make. Chicken, vegetables, meat, all kind of stuff in Ramadan. Now, Eid, we always do barbecue. Always. We grill barbecue and vegetables and salads and tabbouleh and that.
Is that just your family, or that's fairly typical?
That's typical.
So I guess it's very similar to the Jewish Yom HaTzmaut Independence Day.
Yeah, you will smell the meat all over.
What meat is it? Like, is it generally lamb or is it beef? Or?
It's usually lamb.
Locally produced?
Absolutely, always. We never buy that frozen stuff.
We're real chauvinists here in the Galil. We are firmly convinced, we know for a fact that our produce is the best.
I'm sure it's the same throughout the world. If you live in a rural area, an agricultural area, Kent is called the Garden of England for its apple trees and so on, and the people enjoy the local food, and I'm sure it's exactly the same here.
No, I think that's very, very true. as Sada said, and I think I've said to you a few times today, we just, you know, live off the land. I mean, it's not that we don't go to supermarkets, you know, let's not exaggerate, but we just know that the local produce is very good quality and has grown locally, which hasn't been, you know, hasn't been transported, you know, overnight in a truck or for 3 days in a truck or whatever. And so even, you know, even the meat and the beef and everything we often eat locally.
And this is something over the last decade or so that the townies from the centre of the country have discovered. Traditionally, people in Israel would eat the things that they grew up from, the Jewish people who were here, if it was the more Ashkenazi dishes or the more Eastern Moroccan dishes. But the idea that you can go to a local moshav, to a Druze village, to a Muslim town, and have what is produced locally and expand your horizons is something that's very new, but something that lots of Israelis, particularly in the secular world, are taking advantage of.
I think it's very true. I think this whole Israeli foodie scene, let's say local foodie scene, came from the fact that when Israelis start to travel overseas and they'd go, let's say, to Italy, or they'd go to Spain or there, and they would see that there, you know, a lot of the food was locally produced and made, and they'd just say, well, you know, what we have in Israel is at least as good as that, and so why shouldn't we look for that? And then they sort of discovered that the restaurants and the local places and the growers outside of the main cities are just as good as, you know, as, like I said, as what they've seen overseas. So they're now going to start looking for it.
I think it's time for us to end our stereotypical chauvinism of we the men being in the lounge while Sada is in the kitchen working hard, and go and see if we can help her at all.
I think it's a good idea.
Sada, I am full. I have eaten so well. The vine leaves were lovely. The tabbouleh was lovely. And the sweets were out of this world. We are so grateful for your hospitality. Thank you so much.
It's my pleasure. Thank you for coming.
Mark, our time is up. We've got lots of thank yous to say. Can you remember everybody's name?
No. I'd like to say thank you to Radena, Panina, and thank you to Saada.
Perhaps the biggest thank you for givers has to go to Paul Nirons from Galil Eat. Paul, before we close this episode of the podcast, how can people get hold of you?
Either Facebook, which is Galil Eat, or via my website, which is galileat.com, or if you speak Hebrew, galileat.co.il, or via my Instagram, and even by the phone. You can always ring me, 972, of course, 55881027. I love talking, so I'm happy for you to ring or send me an email via my website.
Paul, we've had the most amazing day seeing what the Galilee has to offer, meeting some extremely wonderful families, making a mess of their kitchens, and eating some exquisite food. It's been brilliant. And if ever I give this up and we need someone to take over from me on co-commentary, you are more than welcome.
Thank you very much. I've also enjoyed showing you what I think is the best part of the Galilee, or the best part of Israel, in fact. And that is, you know, my backyard, which is the Galilee. And like I say, I wasn't born here. You can hear that. But I see myself as someone from the Galilee. And I'm glad that I was able to show you guys a little bit of it.
That wraps the Jerusalem Post podcast travel edition for this week.
Goodbye.
Bye-bye from me too.